We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
And welcome to In the Know, the Hornets 24/7 podcast. Your knowledgeable hosts are Michael McNamara.
Me and a grizzly bear, I'm betting on me.
And me, Ryan Schwan.
I've been playing some Dungeons & Dragons because I'm really cool like that.
Let's get it started. All Hornets, all the time.
Welcome to the show. Playoffs are well underway, and the Hornets are sitting on the sidelines and planning their summer. So, of course, that means they're out there scouting players, doing their homework, figuring out what they're going to do for the draft. And to get a little bit of insight into how all that might be working out, we decided to bring on Jerry V. Jerry, thanks for joining us again.
Pleasure. Always a pleasure to be on with you guys. You know that.
So, I mean, that's the first question I have is, people always talk about how when players start doing this workout circuit, that people will shoot up the boards because they're just so impressive. So my question is it really because they come in and you see in front of you that they can jump high, that they can run fast, that they can dominate some second-tier prospect you've brought in to play against them? Or is it part of it the interview process? Because that's a pretty big part of this whole thing too as well, correct?
It's a couple of things. A good example was when Chris Paul visited and how he blew everybody away with all of his quickness and speed drills when they ran him through the whole gambit of all the NBA drills. And they were overwhelmed by how he handled it and his blazing speed. I remember Byron Scott telling me he was the quickest, fastest guy with the ball and how he can do different things, change a direction, et cetera, that he's ever seen before. So that helps. And what it does, too, it puts scouts and coaches, front offices in more of a comfort zone when you're seeing them out of the collegiate element and you're putting them in somewhat of an NBA element where you have what, you know, the famous word people like to use, the measurables. And you can get a hands-on look at a player physically, how they measure out on testing. You know, kind of like a combine thing, but then they can play the one-on-one, the three-on-three. You get a look at what they look like, their reading of the situation of games. And you're right up close. You're right up close, and you can see them at game speed, and you have a measurement to compare them to other potential NBA prospects or to compare them to players you currently have in your roster or how they measure against guys currently in the league on another team's roster. So it does have an effect because sometimes you're scouting guys in collegiate ball games and you might see them three times going up against a team that's just in a zone, or if they're not playing with adequate enough guards, they don't get enough touches. So you can create those scenarios in those tryouts, and then that helps you tremendously.
So, Jerry, as I'm watching the NCAA tournament, I feel like I'm watching a game that resembles almost nothing of what I see on a night-to-night basis in the NBA, whether it's because of the zones or teams just packing the paint, awful ball movement. If you're watching those tapes and you're trying to project a guy, especially defensively, into this league, a guy who, let's take Michael Carter Williams from Syracuse, who played primarily in a zone defensively in such a different kind of game. I mean, mm-hmm. What are you specifically looking at when you try to figure out, can this translate or not?
Well, you're watching him run the floor. You're watching him in situations. How does he defend on the ball? Does he go to the glass? What's his demeanor when he goes to the bench? What's his demeanor? How does he handle himself on the moments of duress following the bad turnover, communication with his coach? You just get a look at a guy in an environment to see how he reconnects to the pressure that's involved. How does he handle it? Does he call for the ball? Does he shy away from the ball? Is he responsive to coaching? You see that. And it's a situation like that where you take that guy out of that environment when you bring him in, and then you could measure his changing ends of the floor, his man-to-man capability, his quickness, all those timing drills. And then with the interview, you learn a lot of different things about him. So there are times you learn a lot of different things about a guy who's not playing in the perfect environment or style of play that you would like to see. So you have to watch him exclusively. You really can't watch a lot of the game. You have to watch him and lose track of parts of the game. You know, you look at him, too, later when a game gets close. It's a three-point game. How's he handling all that? So you learn about all their personalities. The other danger, too, some guys might be playing in a system where they just change ends of the floor, up and down, up and down, up and down, up and down. And you say, wait a minute, you know, okay, can he set a screen? Can he use a screen? Is he a cutter? Does he read things? Or is he a straight-line player? Perfect example of that, I'll use one that guys are familiar with, Julian Wright, who at Kansas, he just had to change ends of the floor. And they played constant up-tempo. He wasn't in enough situations to really measure how he could handle other basketball scenarios. So when he came in, they liked his wingspan. They liked his ability to run, his quickness to the rim. They knew he had inadequacies in his game, so they took him solely on potential and growth possibility because of his youth. So you're right. Some nights it's a torture on the eyeballs to truly get an evaluation of the guy. That's why you try to see him in as many points of the season as you can if he's a high pick. Early in the year, measure his progress mid-year, towards the tail end of the year, and then in the NCAA tournaments to see if you see anything that's either better or something that has slipped from the first time that you saw him play.
All right. So I have a question about just rating defense and offense against one another. In the NBA, scoring gets you paid. That's a clear correlation. The more points you make per game, the more money you generally make in the NBA. But there are players who are difference makers on the defensive end. There's not a lot of them, but there are ones, like Tony Allen comes to mind. Most of these players, especially perimeter ones, only make like contracts. Like Bruce Bowen, I think the most he ever got paid was $4.5 million a year.
Mm-hmm.
When you're going into a college draft and you're looking at players and you have someone out there like Michael Kidd-Gilchrist last year, who mm-hmm. was energy and defense and running the floor, and in some ways Oladipo this year, if you have two players, one who's really good at defense and one that's really good at offense, and you know you'd rate them both as like B players at the other side of the mm-hmm. ball, are you taking the offensive guy every time, no matter what?
It depends on okay. your need, where your inadequacies are, and how many key guys do you have to defend in your particular conference. And again, remember our early conversations many moons ago, you measure yourself against the best 7 or 8 teams you play. Do mm-hmm. they have personnel on that roster that you can counter? If they have wing personnel that can score, do you have personnel that can help limit that wing player? Do you have someone that can, it's somewhat at least, touch the definition of a defensive stopper, because you're not going to shut down great ones, but you can limit them. If you lack that type of a player on your roster, you have to have one. Who's going to guard the premier scorers on the opposing team, the teams that you have to get through to get to the playoffs? So in some cases, that guy might surpass the scorer, because if you go to all scorers and you lack defensive capability, well, then you got a problem. So it depends on where your roster is and what you have to defend to get to that next story in the building. You want to get from the first floor, move up to the second floor, because now you're acquiring personnel that can at least limit the premier scorer of the teams you have to get through.
All right. But as a coach, which is easier to teach, offense or defense?
On the professional level,
yes.
It's your offense. Defensively, it's the toughest transition to make is to defend at this level because of the speed and the strength and the offensive talent and the skill sets and the number of schemes people run. The toughest part of defense to teach is off-the-ball defense, being help in rotating defenders. That's most difficult, but you have to have it because in the NBA, your defense is only as good as your off-the-ball and rotating defenders. So that, to me, that I've always viewed on the collegiate and the high school level also is the defensive side of the ball. Offensive guys, they put on the ground, they can shoot it, they're quick, they're athletic, they can go. But it's the defensive preparation that's a big, big challenge. You know, also studying the game tape, looking at offensive nuances. So defense is a tough, tough teach.
So, I mean, we're talking about some of the measurables and stats. I mean, nowadays we have cameras everywhere, stats on top of stats. We can measure, you know, everything there is. The doctors could get in and poke and prod these guys.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the one area where, you know, teams are still behind, where fans get concerned and you never know what's going to happen, is with the mental aspect. You just, you know, you'll see a scouting report or you'll hear things and you'll just see in the negative column character issues. Now, that could be everything from we've seen guys who smoke weed, get DUIs, to domestic abuse, to getting in a fight with a coach. I mean, it really runs a spectrum.
Yeah, it could be a long list. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, you can't throw every guy out, who, you know, just has character's concerns. You have to kind of get in and dissect that and figure out, you know, what you can live with and what you can't.
What
particular character issues do you think are unfixable or would just make you take a guy off your board? And which ones do you dig a little deeper into and see if you could help the young guy?
All right. First of all, on top of that whole topic is the talent worth absorbing some of the baggage? If he is a superior talent, he is that guy who's got it. He has that game, and he is the guy that addresses and fills, you know, urgent needs that you have, but he may have a certain streak of being uncoachable. He may be immature. Well, then you address it differently on the status of your roster. Case in point, if we take this young, very talented guy, does my roster currently have a couple of guys that can help monitor him? You know, we've spoken about that healthy peer pressure, and here's where it comes in here. Or do I have too many young guys and I can't handle this guy? Or do I hire a guy that I can have to monitor him and help him? Again, it's the how much talent does he have? An abundance of talent where he is an absolute dynamite player may allow some teams to say, you know what? The upside on this guy is so high, I got to live with a couple of negatives. You know, besides the point of you don't want guys that are involved in criminal activity, et cetera, different story there, but I think you see my point. A lot of that has to do as well with what do you currently have on your roster that can help assist that player.
So looking at the Hornets roster right now.
Let me give you part B. Some of the things that may force you to take a guy off the board might be a criminal record, might be a drug issue, might be those two. You know, there can be a red flag. A guy that was physically violent with teammates, who totally ignored the coach, who's constantly late. And you go around and you interview people that know him and you find out, because everybody has in the professional league, everybody has a group of guys that can find information about players to seek out character check. Everyone has that. They can find out what they want about a guy. And then you determine whether or not he is worth the risk. NFL people know that more than anybody because they have to stock so many players on a roster. There are indeed guys you will take a risk on because their talent can take you and move you up another notch or maybe two. But it's one of the tough dilemmas. That's why I've always said the toughest thing to do in pro sports is to build a roster and then manage it. Toughest challenge in the game, any game at the pro level.
All right. So, I mean, looking just at the Hornets, and I don't think in this draft there aren't too many people that have character issues I'd be worried about.
Keep calling them the Hornets. It's your
the Hornets.
Yeah.
The Pelicans. Pelicans! I'm going to make that mistake for years. There's no one in this draft, though, that particularly scares me personality-wise. I mean, there's a couple guys that have, like, a couple small red flags, but nothing I'm worried about. But let's say something like DeMarcus Cousins becomes available on the trade market.
Mm-hmm.
Looking at this Hornets roster, do you see the kind of guys? I mean, I know Monty's a strong personality, but you got to have players on the floor. Does this roster have the sort of thing to absorb a talent like that and
no,
be able to control them?
Not yet. Unless they acquire a couple of veteran guys that come on the roster that can help police that locker room. I can't overemphasize the significance of a healthy peer pressure in a locker room. It is absolutely a requirement if you have any ambition of becoming a legitimate playoff team. You must have it. There's too many things that go on. There's practice and shoot-arounds and the bus and the team playing and the discipline and the eating habits and the social habits and the maturity of working on your game and the resiliency that's needed to when you're having that down streak and a young player gets down on himself. Who is the mentor that can tell him I've been there, that has some credibility, has a story to tell? And guys have a story to tell that have spent time in the league, and they have that reputation. And until you get your roster to that level, some of the risks can really implode for you. You're too young. You do not win big in this league if your roster is too young at too many levels. For that's just one of the reasons other than the experience. You can't ask your head coach to be that guy. The job is too demanding. He can commute to a certain level with a player and influence a player, but he also needs mentors in the locker room that could be that second voice for the coach. Because players will listen to teammates. They'll listen. If they hear a coach say, you know, hey, you can't be coming late to practice. You're not putting enough gym time to work on your game. And the player's like, come on, you know, I got talent. But then when some teammates come up and say, you know what, coach is right, it's a different tune. That's why coaches can wear a player out if they're the one that always has to do all the talking. You need other voices.
So, I mean, we're talking about putting this roster together and no better time than the playoffs as, you know, we obviously see what winning basketball looks like in the NBA. All these teams, save for Milwaukee, who's already home, had winning records this year. Are you beginning to notice or do you see any trends? I mean, I know that you have your rules of basketball. You have things that, you know, consistently winning teams have every year. But do you see anything that really stands out as far as this new day and age with the more of the small ball in the NBA that the Pelicans are really going to have to get moving forward and they lack in a supreme way that they're going to have to add to get to this level?
As far as personnel and basketball talent?
Yes.
Yeah, they got to get better guards. They got to upgrade that point guard position. They got to get quicker, and they need to add a little length there. And then the intangible in that, they need to become a grittier team. They're not there yet.
Do you I mean, yeah, you see a team like the Bulls, everybody wants to talk about how, you know, they're missing Rose, and, you know, you would expect them to fall by the wayside, and it looks like they're going to win a first round series. And I mean, what is it that a team like that has? You talk about grittiness and toughness. I mean, is that something that you could develop, or is that going to be dependent on Dell to go out this summer and bring in from outside of the organization?
You got to find players that have that as part of their personality trait. You can see guys that come into the league and they're tough guys, and they get tougher and grittier as their confidence soars. But you have to have that in you, and you have to find that in the personality. And that's an intangible right now that I think is lacking on this club. There is a difference to playing hard and being gritty and being just tough. It's a personality mindset. That's one of the intangibles that needs to be to also be introduced in the club. And I think the best path for them to follow that would to add a couple of guys that have been in this league to help in the locker room, number one, and number two, that have a toughness in some particular area that can be passed along to their teammates. The mental toughness of it that's coupled with that, that just, you know, when you see a guy play, the eye test will never go away, regardless of the metrics and all the statistical sophistication that's been introduced. The eye test still tells you an awful lot. You can watch a guy and go, that's a tough kid. And you need a couple of those.
Yeah, I can't pick even one player out on this team who I would call tough.
Yeah, and you know, I watch the Hornets play a lot, and then I go back, you know, and you look at metrics, and I like the statistical breakdowns on what they do as a team. But those things, I always believe my eyes when I watch a player. And I can look at a guy and say, he could play, but he needs to work on A and B, but he can still play. Let's clean up the jumper a little bit. Let's work on this part of his game. And if he does that, he becomes better. Because let's face it, guys are paid to get better. But then you can also watch a guy with the eye test and say, goodness gracious, he doesn't hit the ground. He can't bounce off the second contact. If he takes a little pop on the first effort to the rebound, there isn't the second one. He doesn't battle in the crowd. He looks like he's battling when he's not in traffic. He does play hard, but what's his productivity? So the eye test to me is invaluable, coupled with the other things that you look for to break it down. And that's something that this club, I think, desperately needs.
All right. So keeping along with watching the playoffs thing, Western Conference, it's in a lot of ways this feels like an end of an era to me. Dallas isn't in there anymore. L.A. is imploding. I mean, the Spurs keep going and probably will be going 20 years from now, and we'll all be saying, oh, next year they're done, and they'll still be playing well. But there are finally some new teams breaking in to the playoffs, making noise. Houston, Golden State. I mean, OKC's been there, so we'll throw them out for now because they're obviously going to be dangerous. But other than OKC, looking at the field of teams that are in the playoffs this year, which team scares you the most as a rival for supremacy in the Western Conference for the Pelicans over the next few years?
Well, one, it'll be, as long as Greg Popovich is in San Antonio, he'll be there. If Oklahoma City, which will face some major roster decisions over the next 2 years, can continue to tweak their team the way San Antonio does, they'll be there. The Lakers are slipping because the management has taken on a whole new persona. And quite frankly, the younger bust hasn't shown that he is the guy that will hire the people required. He seems to be hiring people from in his inner circle. If you're friends of his, you'll get hired. That's the worst thing you can do. And they got cap issues and all. So they got some tough, tough decisions to make. They can get things going. Remains to be seen. I think Oklahoma City, San Antonio, I think with Golden State with an addition, if they can keep personnel, they could be fun to watch. They're getting better as a ball team. They've been through enough doldrums to try to make that move. Those impressed me. Dallas, big decisions. Lakers, big decisions. Denver, slippage in the playoffs. I don't know what happened to their ball movement. They could be on the verge of showing some slippage if they don't freshen up that roster a little bit. So I think it's an Oklahoma City, San Antonio for now in the West. Phoenix still has some work to do. The Pelicans have work to do. So I think right now it's those teams that I have mentioned, unless one has slipped my memory. Sacramento needs to have work. So a lot of teams in the West do have work to do. You know, San Antonio's getting older. The Ginobili, Parker, Duncan thing can't continue. How long will Popovich coach? And when they replace him, it's going to be when he wants to leave. And will the guy be able to do what Popovich does? You know, and it's more than just coaching the X and O's. He's just the master on how he communicates with his players and all. So that's the way the West sits right now. I think there's opportunities for teams to make a nice move over the next 2 years.
So the one team that you left out that I think is pretty telling, because Michael likes to mock the rest of this guy, the roster on this team, and I'm not too far behind him, the Los Angeles Clippers.
Oh, I failed to mention the Clippers. That's a good point. I apologize. But they have decisions to make with Chris Paul after this season. He wants more talent added to that roster. And right now, they don't strike me as the team. While they are talented on the floor, they still don't strike me as the team that has the basketball grit to truly start to make noise. I think they have a whole lot of flash, but they need to add the substance side. Now, they've had some major winning streaks this year. Is it Del Negro that's afraid to push and bark? Because eventually, you're going to have to take your team and push it to the brink if you have any aspirations of winning a title. I don't know if that collection of guys can do that. I think that they lack a couple of pieces of guys, like a Chauncey Billups type that can keep that team glued together and locked into focus. I think they got wrapped into that L.A. mystique a little bit, and I watched them play. Sometimes I watch him and I go, what the blank are you people trying to do here? You know what I mean? It's again the eye test. That consistency of this is a really good team. I see a lot of flash, but on several occasions the substance just seems to vanish, if that makes sense.
No, that makes perfect sense.
So we've talked about some other teams. We've also talked about scouting guys that we want to bring in here to improve, but there still is the matter of our core that we currently have here right now, namely Anthony Davis, and you could throw in some other guys like Austin Rivers possibly too. If you're Monty and Dell, what specifically are you telling them this summer as far as where they should go to work on their game? Do you want them
– go ahead and pick a player.
So let's go Anthony Davis. Do you want him in New Orleans? I know Monty has told – him and Austin, that he wants them to play in the UCLA pickup games. But, I mean, are you sending Anthony Davis? Are you outsourcing him? Are you sending him to Pete Newell's big man camp or Olajuwon? Or would you prefer that the guys are here working on stuff? What are the pros and cons of them going out on their own and working individually on their game versus staying local and in your program?
I use the old schoolyard rule growing up. I always kept the ball and sneakers and stuff in the trunk of the car. I remember my high school coach telling me, you don't get better by just playing in Queens. You got to go into Brooklyn. You got to go into Manhattan. You need to go to the places where the games are, and you need to play against a variety of competition to test your game. And then when you do that, when you come back to the gym here in the summer nights, when we have open gym, you know where your game is. I want you to go out and play against the all-city guy, the all-New York City guy that played in the public school league. You are in the Catholic school league. Go play against those guys. Go find the runs. We used to drive all over the place to find games. Same story. You want Anthony Davis to go someplace where he can see other guys in a non-structured environment. Dialogue's a little different. The style of play is a little different. You're calling your own fouls. the advice to go to UCLA and play, and I've been out there to watch games. It's tremendous. So you go to Chapel Hill in North Carolina, where all the Carolina guys come back and play, and et cetera. Go to places where the game is. You have to expose your game and test your game against a variety of competition to measure where you are. And then you need individual gym time to work on what you can't do. See, during the season, there's a rule that I believe in. During the season, you do the things you can do. In the summer, you work on the things you can't do. You go on the road with the list from your coach and your evaluation of what you need to work on, and that's what you work on individually and then in competition to see if it's working. And you have the whole summer to get it at the game level. So, yes, absolutely that for Anthony, plus a strength program, no doubt. He needs to get stronger up in the shoulders because of the contact you get in rebounding, the arms, the chest area, strengthen the lower waist. He's never going to be big with a lot of girth, but that wiry strength so he can take the contact. Don't worry, they're not to battle off any shoulder injury with the grabbing and the bumping. So those two things, strength and game enhancement. He's got to have a solidified two go-to moves, and coupled with strength will allow him to do a couple of things he couldn't get away with this year.
So if you're telling Anthony Davis to do that, do you want Austin Rivers? Like, if you can influence at all, and you can tell those two guys go together to UCL games or go to Chapel Hill?
No, not necessarily. Yeah. Sometimes okay. Together, because you want them to be able to play with other people and adjust to other people and different personalities. That's part of the game discipline. You know, you want Austin Rivers to go up and you know, he might go someplace and say, you know, on these nights I'm going to work on my playmaking. I'm going to set guys up. Maybe in a different night I'll work on being a scorer, because he needs to balance out his game. He needs to do those things. So when he goes out with great competition, and if he's flanked by a wing guy or two that can really score the ball, on that particular night he can work on playmaking, his setup game, advancing the ball, pushing it, swinging it, getting into the swing of things, running pick and rolls with bigs, you know, the basic schoolyard stuff that still makes you a tough player. And then the stuff additionally individually in the gym, working on the jumper, the off the dribble. Because if he mixes that in playing the full court, it will enhance his decision making. And he needs to do that. And he'll learn. And the only way you do that is to play. And expose yourself to different situations, whether it's 3-on-3 and then mixed in with your full court.
All right. To follow up on one thing on Austin Rivers, I got to do his season in review for our website.
Right.
And, I mean, it was a bad season. There's no way you can get away from the fact that overall his production was very poor.
Mm-hmm.
But then I tried to, you know, get to, like, well, did he improve? And if you look at his last 15 games, all of his numbers came out much better. I mean, he still wasn't great by any means. He was average. But the question is does that match what you saw on the court? Was he better as the season progressed and he got better?
He got better in a few areas, and I thought he leveled off in some. I thought he got better. He was never afraid to attack the rim. But at times he would attack the rim at the wrong time. So the personality is there to be an attack guy. He just didn't know when to attack, when not to attack. You know, he didn't read the lane going to the rim. Oh, let me just run, fly in here. Then boom, offensive charge. Or let me come flying in here with my head down and miss the guys on the baseline because the big's coming up to guard me. Or I'm missing the guy in the corner. Or I need my pull-up game. So, but at least he had the relentless part of his personality with the willingness to go to the rim. That got a little bit better as the season went on. He still needs work on his jumper. He still needs work on his court vision as he advances the ball. And he really struggled, I thought, this year on when to shoot, when to pass, and at times keeping the ball in his hands too long. But he's still incredibly young, very young. So this year I think he'll do a lot for his confidence, and you're not going to recognize him physically coming into next season. And let's just use next season, because I could add the season after. Because of his youth, he will get stronger. He'll look a little bit bigger. he's one that truly needs to get out there and play and have somebody get up in his grill during the summer so he can become the better guard. Then on certain nights, he needs to play the point. On other nights, he needs to play the swing so he can truly learn how to communicate verbally, how to use screens, how to get open, how to catch and score, how to catch and be and throw the scoring pass. All those come because that's the joy of the summer. Point guard for a few nights. Tonight I'll play the swing. And then he learns a lot about himself as a player. And then he'll make that move. But decision-making. So he showed some nice moments and some nice improvement. Still has a ways to go. But I thought he made some decent progress in certain areas that I mentioned.
So you're not, you think that maybe in 2 years, part of the rotation, pretty valuable?
Yeah, possible? I think he'd be good. He's such a baby. He's so young. You look at him. I'm down court level. I look at him, and I remember talking to him and Gravis one day in a hallway, and I said, looked at him. I go, my goodness, you know, people forget. He just came out of Duke. You know, can you imagine what he looks like in 3 more years? You know, yeah. You look at your high school pictures, and then look at your college pictures. You see a difference. You see your college pictures and then the pictures when you're out of college and you've been in the pros a couple of years. He's 1 year in college, right? One.
Yep.
Incredibly young, and that will come. I think he has the talent to be a pretty nice player.
And I know the three of us are probably a little skeptical, but in his exit interviews, Gravis Vasquez said that he was going to spend the summer working on his lateral mobility and his explosion. You know, I think we all know that he's, no matter how much work he puts in, he'll never turn into Derrick Rose or Russell Westbrook, maybe the version of them when they're injured, but not there in the prime on the court version. But is explosion and lateral movement, are those things that can be, you know, at least marginally improved? And for Vez,
yeah, they can. They can. I mean, he's not all of a sudden going to become a Jet. But, yeah, footwork helps. Reading angles along with the improved footwork will help. The explosion, working new muscles on your body to help. Yeah, that'll help. That can help you a little bit. His decision-making needs to improve. And he'll never be the Jet. But he can improve slightly in those areas. Sure, he can. But eventually, it's tough to guard who the king is on the floor when they have the tremendous quickness, and it'll help him. It's not going to help him where you're going to go, wow, this guy can fly now. It won't be to that degree, but let's give the kid credit for recognizing where he needs to get work done.
I mean, how big of an improvement would you say he would have to make to where, you know, it's not such a glaring weakness that it kind of negates all the other things that he does that are fairly positive? Are we talking about a marginal improvement? I mean, I watched Andre Miller, who's 38 years old, and I mean, you would believe that if Vasquez could get to his quickness or a little faster, he could be a quality player in this league. I mean, does he have to get that much quicker and more explosive, or are we talking?
You know, guys, you when they look at you, there's guys out there that work with guys, you know, the physiological side of body structure, fast twitch muscles, length and strength, and all of that. Yeah, he can improve his quickness to a degree, but as I mentioned, he's not gonna come back and blow your mind with tremendous quickness. You might see a slight improvement because his footwork technique sometimes is off. He doesn't read angles that well defensively. On the ball will be an issue against quick guys always because of the no-touch rule on the perimeter. But I think if he works on his alertness, his reading angles and situations when he's off the ball, when to give space to the premier ball handler, when not to give space against a guy that's not as quick, I think it's more of a question of angles and knowledge of the particular situation against who you're guarding. With the enhancement of footwork improvement, they can come with some strength development and some drills he can do to at least appear to look like he's a little bit quicker. But I think it's the other areas more so than it is with what it is what it is. He's never going to be that Jet. But you try to disguise what you lack in some of that quickness by just being a smarter player and learning angles and when not to commit and understand who you're guarding, which is an invaluable thing to know in this league. Or at any level in basketball.
Right. All right, so you got anything else for Jerry, Michael?
I mean, I would be remiss. It was a historic day today in the NBA. Jason Collins coming
right
up. Just any thoughts that you have for any of our listeners, your first thoughts when you heard the news today?
Yes, accept it. It's a new day. It's a new era. To be naive to think that there aren't any gay athletes in the professional league or the collegiate league would be incredibly naive. And I can understand why some people may have an issue with it, but you just ask the fans to think back and review why an issue. Why are you threatened? If the player, like any other player, doesn't disrupt the locker room, doesn't force his lifestyle upon you, and he's a team player, and he gets rave reviews from coaches and teammates, and he was a tough kid. He started for over 495 games. At one time, he was top three in his position for taking offensive charges. He battled Shaq. He battled Howard. He was a gritty, tough big man, 12 years in the league, played in 9 playoff series. You know, he won 2 state high school titles. He'd been to the Final Four. He'd been to the Elite Eight several times. This is a tough hombre as far as a basketball player. So if you evaluate him as the player that you saw with that size as opposed to Fender, he's a guy that'll help somebody. He's lasted 12 years. The age might be, he said he's 34. So accept it. And then I ask you this. What happens if the Pelicans, or the Saints for that matter, the Pelicans win an NBA title, the Saints win another Super Bowl, but let's do it to basketball because it's Hornets 24/7. And a guy drops 20 in one night, 11 boards, 3 blocks, and he is the guy that came up the floor in a game 7 for an NBA title. He knocks down a 3, turns the ball over, steals it, gets the layup, is fouled, goes to the line, makes the winning free throws, and you win an NBA title. And then he comes out in his joy and happiness and says, I'm so happy we brought New Orleans a title, but I have to get it off my chest. I'm gay. What are you going to do, give the trophy back? Think about it.
No, I think that would probably be the best thing possible in a lot of ways.
Think about it. We needed a Jackie Robinson.
Yeah.
Who's going to be that type of guy that's going to come out? Does it have to be a premier player? Does it have to be an all-star? Some people say that that's the case. The case in point, I was never naive to think that, and I learned my lesson when I was 16 years old, when we were short a guy for a summer league game. And one of the guys that lived in my building, he was a little older because I was playing in the older league and it was the 16 to 19-year-old, and he asked if he could play on our team. And we said, yeah, we need a guy. And he played with us. And nobody could guard him. Nobody. And it turned out he was gay. And it never dawned on us. You know, you're young, you go, okay, he's gay. Wow, well, we didn't know that. Whoa, when you're young, you're a teenager. Whoa, boy, that's something. Boy, he could really play, you know. But that day forward taught me a lesson that because a guy is gay, it doesn't mean he doesn't have a serious game, and it doesn't mean that he's not a gym rat that won't work on his game. And here we are in 2013, and to be naive to the fact of that is something I would find quite surprising. If you're going to try to convince yourself that there aren't gay players playing in professional sports, somebody's not paying attention to the world. Case in point, at the Boston Marathon explosion, if you saw that cop who saved one of those runners and ran out there to help get runners off the street that were running in the race, and he was, I think he made the cover of Sports Illustrated, that was a gay cop that did not deny him at all, or that did not deny the person that was rescued the fact that a hero showed up with all that crap going on, and he was gay. So what did that have to do with the cop being a hero and a cop that cared about saving lives?
Right. Yeah, no, I agree. It's a day that, you know, is great
for different world
sports. Yeah, I can't wait to see where it goes from here.
It's a different day and age, gentlemen, and there are some people. And you don't see it in the younger generation. You're seeing a lot of the young players in the league, and the sophistication of the NBA is ahead of the curve because LeBron came out and Dwayne Wade and several others came out in support of Collins for what he did and his bravery. He's a brave guy. And I would tell any player, and if he came up to me and said, "Coach, but I'm gay, don't be late for practice, be on time, don't be late for the bus, work on your game, and be coachable."
Hmm. Same message you delivered to all of them, right?
Exactly.
All right, Jerry. Thanks for coming on.
It's always a pleasure, gentlemen. Always a pleasure.
Thank you so much.